You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, February 2nd, 2025. My name is Bill McCann, and I'll read the featured story, Invasive Crabs Have Taken Over New England, and then see if there's time for any other stories. So, invasive crabs have taken over New England. One solution? Eat them. America's northeastern coast has been overrun by crabs from Europe and Asia. Luckily, they're delicious. It's an article by C.J. Chivers. For several years, while teaching at the University of Vermont, Joe Roman, a conservation biologist, challenged students to an unusual exercise. Design an animal ideal for the role of marine invader, he'd say, a creature with the natural traits to colonize a territory not its own, and in the relentlessly competitive scrum of the wild, establish itself sturdily for the long term. Roman has spent decades studying how species travel the globe, multiplying beyond pioneering toeholds to something like ubiquity and change ecosystems. His classroom exercise invariably landed as a living example on one little-known but astonishingly widespread member of the animal kingdom, the European green crab. Small, fertile, rugged, and fueled by an expansive appetite, the species, he said, is an exemplary invader. A perfect invader. European green crabs originally hail from the northeastern Atlantic Ocean and the southwestern Baltic Sea. Roman ticked off traits that helped them conquer much of the world. As omnivores, scavengers, and cannibals, they sustain themselves on almost any organic food. They have a high fecundity, with females releasing as many as 185,000 eggs a year. They survive in water temperatures from freezing to 86 degrees Fahrenheit and tolerate sweet water zones where salt meets fresh. Moreover, adult European green crabs can live 10 days or more out of water. Taken together, these characteristics explain why they were first documented along the United States coast in 1817 and continue their tour of the temperate world. My curiosity about European green crabs began after witnessing their near indestructibility beside my own home. Our family fishes commercially in New England, where we grow or catch a substantial portion of our food. About 15 years ago, my children and I began capturing bushels of European green crabs for use as fertilizer. The process was simple. We harvested crabs in baited wire mesh traps in an estuary in southern Rhode Island. Every so often, we transferred bushels into coolers of tap water, where we expected they would die, as lobsters quickly do when immersed in fresh water. We'd then dump their limp carcasses into compost piles and cover them under a foot of decomposing leaves, vegetable scraps, and manure. One day, not long after one of these deposits, a neighbor arrived at our yard's edge. He seemed bemused, and he asked if I knew anything about the crabs picking their way across his property. He had discovered the exploded chitlin ecoskeleton of an itinerant crustacean after hearing a thunk under his lawnmower. "Yes," I admitted, "I did." Upon inspecting the compost, we found that an untold number of crabs we thought dead had unearthed themselves and walked off. Over the next week, we found more, hiding in shade, crouched under purple dead nettle, pressed against the base of a shed. A murder of crows feasted on them. Crabs kept turning up. If self-exhumation and 100-yard crab walks sounds like useful skills for population expansion, they are. But when I recounted the story for Roman over a crab dinner, he smiled knowingly and suggested that the amphibian prowess of an adult European green crab, impressive as it was not the species' most infiltrative trait. That title was better assigned to the survivability of their larvae. After hatching from eggs, larval green crabs drift for 60 days or more, which means they can ride oceanic currents for months to settle in new locales. Combine this natural endurance with patterns of human logistics, and a mechanism for planetary dispersal becomes clear. The first arrival of green crabs in North America, Roman says, were more likely adults clinging to ballast rocks and bricks in wooden ships. In more recent generations, globe-roaming cargo vessels have taken on seawater and ports as ballast, ingesting an uncountable quantity of green crab larvae and discharging them wherever each vessel moored next. The scale can stretch the imagination. In the ballast of a single ship, Roman says, you can have tens of millions of larvae of green crabs and other coastal species. Most larvae, he says, don't survive long journeys. Green crab larvae do. Aided by these skills, green crabs have established themselves in the Pacific Northwest, Japan, South Africa, South America, and Australia. Many modern ballast systems now have filtration and treatment systems to prevent the movement of small organisms. The crab's adaptability carries serious consequences for inshore habitat and fisheries in the northeastern United States. European green crabs are voracious and feed on native crabs, shellfish, and juvenile lobsters, driving down local abundance. In the process, they uproot native plant species, weakening marine nurseries and storm buffers created by eelgrass and spartina. Mary Parks, founder of greencrab.org, a nonprofit that educates the public on the harm green crab cause, says their estuary-altering characteristics amplify the erosive effects of climate change. Because they face few local predators, she added, their populations can explode. An exception appears to be an estuary on the California coast, where green crabs are enjoyed by sea otters. The damage in New England drove Roman and Parks toward a shared goal, mitigating the crab's effects by encouraging people to be like those otters. Roman is founder and editor of Eat the Invaders website, Fighting Invasive Species One Bite at a Time, its banner proclaims, cementing his position of the movement to put non-native plants and animals on plates. As a conservation biologist, my goal is not to kill anything, he says. I wish it was that simple. I'm in this to protect native biodiversity. A lot of times when species are having an ecological impact, just letting it run its course is not always the right answer. Some invasive species don't lend themselves to eating. Lantern flies won't be on your favorite local restaurant's menu anytime too soon. When it comes to crabs, the idea has promise. Americans consume enormous amounts of seafood, and several favorites, tuna, scallops, lobster, salmon, summer flounder, striped bass, can be prohibitively expensive for many households. It's not hard to imagine low-cost crab finding a customer base. They are abundant beyond measure, easy to catch, and enjoyed in Italy and Spain, where diners eat European and Mediterranean green crab eggs or molting whole crabs as delicacies. I know how delicious the crabs can be firsthand, as my family renders batches of green crabs into a savory, full-bodied stock. The result becomes the basis for ramen. There's one obstacle to eating our way out of the problem. A big bull green crab might boast a carapace 4 inches across. Most are considerably smaller. The carapace of a prized Maryland blue crab, for comparison, can spread 9 inches across. The green crab's small stature means their tiny claws, legs, and the segmented chambers of their bodies, the parts people typically devour, are difficult to pick, which can make for time-consuming preparations and tedious eating. The species possesses many traits that aid its spread. Its small size is one that has protected it from human consumption so far. Zach Appletoft eased his skiff alongside a yellow and green boy floating above a serpentine channel on the Great Marsh, the estuary straddling the Massachusetts-New Hampshire line. Reaching for the boy, he pulled a crab trap up through murky water and shook out a dense mass of crabs into a sorting box. Several dozen green crabs righted themselves and scurried to corners, seeking escape. The sound of legs scratching wood rose over the skiff's idling engine. Working fast, Appletoft swept the crabs through a hole in the box down into a sack, then throttled to the next trap. It was packed with green crabs, too. So was the third trap, and the trap after that. On it went, across the marsh. A young clam harvester who yearns for a long career on the water, Appletoft has watched the crab's effect up close. His clam catch has fallen as the crab population has soared. "We're digging like 3 times less than we were," he said of the soft shell clams known as steamers that provide his livelihood. The natural channel where he trapped crabs, he said, was formerly hemmed tight by marsh grass. Now the channel is wide. Scientists differ on how much damage green crabs do to plant communities. Appletoft says their effects where he fishes are severe. "The crabs make burrows and turn the marsh into Swiss cheese," he said. "Then storms come and peel the marsh away." He nodded toward Crane Beach, a natural sand barrier that has receded for years, exposing the estuary to waves during nor'easters. "The marsh," he said, "has lost resiliency to withstand powerful waves that roll through the widening gap. How this dynamic will play out is anyone's guess." Appletoft sees depressing possibilities: a retreat of vegetation, a dwindling of biodiversity and fisheries, an increase in erosion threatening roads, businesses, and homes. Declining clam stock prompted Appletoft to participate in a crab cull. Even if markets remain stubbornly small, he pursues a 3-pronged approach. On this day, he planned to drop sacks of crabs at a farm for composting. On other days, he provides crabs to tackle shops for resale as bait. A portion of his catch also goes to Wolf's Fish, a seafood wholesaler and retailer in Boston that sells green crabs online. Wolf's claims to be the first company to offer invasive crabs nationally. It introduced its frozen European green crabs in 2021. The company sold about 2,000 pounds the first year. It was a ton of green crabs that hadn't been removed from the water before, so in that respect it was a lot, said Alicia Linlia, the company's vice president for marketing. "But compared to anything else that comes through our warehouse, it was a very, very minuscule amount." Several chefs have since taken interest, and demand has ticked up slightly. Sales in 2024 reached 3,000 pounds, all of them provided by Appletoft. Wolf's can feel like a glimpse into the future, if only because green crabs are not alone as an untapped non-native food source awaiting a market. Many crabs are adept stowaways. Other species have traveled far too. The blue crab of the United States Eastern Shore, a culturally important species indelibly associated with the Chesapeake Bay, has colonized the Mediterranean Sea, where fishing communities and ecologists worry over its effects. In the Northeast, European green crabs have yielded habitat to a more recent arrival, Asian shore crabs, which are native to the western Pacific Ocean from Hong Kong to Russia's Sakhalin Island. One egg-bearing Asian shore crab was discovered near Delaware Bay in 1988. Recognizing an opportunity to study an invasion's real-time expansion, scientists tracked the spread. It happened quickly. By 1995, Asian shore crabs were documented from North Carolina to Massachusetts. By 2012, the species became, according to scientific literature, quote, the dominant crab in rocky intertidal habitat along much of the northeast coast. Asian shore crabs tend to be more aggressive than their cousins from Europe and eat shellfish and other small crustaceans too. The combination led to predictable results. In rocky areas where European green crabs once swarmed, Asian shore crabs have generally driven them off. The coastline where I live is now dominated by these two crustaceans. Crabs from Europe in mud and marsh, crabs from Asia in the rocks. Almost no one is eating any of them. Marking them for consumption based on their origin alone comes with the potential for hypocrisy, including selective use of the word invasive. Honeybees aren't from North America, but there's no movement to knock their numbers down. Instead, there is substantial public distress around stories of their decline. You won't often hear them called invasive. House cats are not native either and kill enormous amounts of indigenous as well as invasive wildlife every year. They remain immensely popular. Moreover, origin stories don't predetermine ecological effects. Many native flora and fauna can cause harm. Whatever label best applies to non-native crabs, their rich taste positions them well for reconsideration. To put a dent in populations and enjoy free local food, some harvesters eat them whole, either seared, stewed, boiled, or fried. Deep-fried green crab bodies, I'm telling you, would be an excellent bar food, says John Painter, a harvester and home cook in Maine, who has been experimenting with recipes. If you like seafood, it's freaking amazing. Painter is among the harvesters experimenting with holding green crabs in floating cages until they molt and can be eaten as soft shells, a preparation rivaling the flavor and consistency of the soft shell blue crabs of the Chesapeake. Other cooks shatter hard shell whole crabs under a heavy object or in a blender, then boil the mash, techniques mimicking preparations in Vietnam, where small rice paddy crabs are popular in a crab noodle soup known as bun ryu. Boiling broken crabs causes the meat to float, to be skimmed for use in crab cakes, fried rice, or soups. Still, green crab consumers remain outliers. Those who sell crabs commercially have found markets not yet clamoring for many more. Even though Wolf's is accessible to anyone with an internet connection, Appletoft's catch is enough. There's no need to employ a second harvester. Wolf's takes the long view, seeing its effort as an environmental project and a local fisheries project. Lumia says, "We're doing this because we think it's an important thing to do." To put the crabs in front of consumers, Wolf's blast freezes them whole, swiftly bringing them down to minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit before packing them in 2-pound bags that sell for $10. The sales pitch is straightforward. "It's crab," Lumia says. "It tastes like crab. It's not strange." But for the market to expand sharply, she says, someone will have to find uses with the mass appeal of an industrial-scale product. That will be a tipping point, she says. Until then, the movement relies on restaurants to put green crabs before the public. Chefs, she says, are so important in helping make the fashion. One chef who's worked green crabs into his cooking is David Standridge, who with his wife Kathleen founded the Shipwright's Daughter, a restaurant in Mystic, Connecticut that emphasizes sustainability. Standridge first heard of the species almost 20 years ago when the renowned French chef Joël Robuchon, whom Standridge worked for in New York, assigned him to buy crabs for a dish on the menu and urged him to find green crabs. He said, "In Europe, we use them for stock, and it's the best crab for stock," Standridge recalls. He struggled to find them, and when the Shipwright's Daughter opened in 2020, he still had no source. Parks connected him to a fisherman trapping green crabs in estuaries. The restaurant now goes through about 200 pounds a week, working them into several dishes, including seared scallops on green crab fried rice with garlic aioli and a crudo of big-eye tuna drizzled with crab-infused oil. Standridge raves about the oil he makes with his weekly delivery of live crabs, which cost about a dollar a pound. "It's crazy," he said. "It's basically free." Last year, Standridge was recognized by the James Beard Foundation with a Best Chef in the Northeast Award. "The honor," he said, "provides a platform to promote the crab's value." "When you get that kind of recognition," he says, "other people start copying you, which is what we want." Another project is in the works at St. Hours and Company of Weymouth, Massachusetts, which hopes to make the crabs a pantry staple. For decades, the company has sold dehydrated clam broth. A few years ago, after hearing Parks speak about the damage invasive crabs cause, Sharon St. Hours, the company's vice president, decided to add green crab stock to its product line. The method gets around the crab's small size by focusing on a concentrate of the species flavor. "It just seems like a perfect fit for what we do," she said. In 2023, the company received an almost $50,000 grant from Massachusetts to develop a consumer product, and it plans to reveal it, St. Hours Crab Broth Powder, at an international seafood show in Boston in March. "Our next step," St. Hours says, "is we need customers to buy it." Bun Lai, a chef who has advocated for invasive crab consumption for more than 20 years, stood in a food preparation zone that he calls his lab, checking on small crabs in a dehydrator. A print of Picasso's Don Quixote hung on a wall. Lai's lab is one part of Mia's in the Woods, a private embassy from the world of sustainable sustenance in a meadow in the oak forest of Woodbridge, Connecticut. It's the latest physical iteration of a food ethos formerly embodied in Mia's Sushi, a restaurant in New Haven, now closed, that held a vanguard position in bringing invasive species to patrons. The grounds contain stands of wild invasive plants, an outdoor kitchen and dining area, and a personal bistro for Lai's guests. Lai is not strictly an invasivore, as consumers of non-native species sometimes call themselves. But he insists that targeted eating of certain invasive species can relieve pressures on ecosystems and be healthier than many store-bought meal choices, with the potential, he says, to be environmentally regenerative, unlike our current food system, which is often destructive. As long as 20 years ago, Mia's Sushi offered European green crabs and Asian shore crabs on its menus, as well as silver carp, lionfish, mugwort, Japanese knotweed, and other non-native species the Lai family considers fine dining ingredients that supermarkets overlook. Nowadays, with the same species, Bun and his sister Mi host dinners as forage to feast food diplomacy, with Bun as chief gatherer, supervisory cook, and not least, knowing ambassador from the world of sustainable sustenance. All this was on display at an invasive crab supper last year. Live froze a sack of live European green crabs provided by Harvey Cataldo, an oyster farming friend of mine in Rhode Island who traps crabs to protect juvenile oyster stock, along with a haul of Asian shore crabs caught by volunteers scouring the shoreline of Long Island Sound. The organization Parks leads, greencrab.org, promotes recipes that center European green crabs, including spicy curry green crab, furlong bisque, green crab tomato soup, and green crab scampi. Lai has his own dishes to add, from appetizers to desserts. He pitched the results boldly, suggesting in essence that whatever their origins, invasive crabs are now local and merit a place on tables. European green crabs and Asian shore crabs belong in the pantheon of New England coastal ingredients, he says, standing proudly alongside lobsters, oysters, clams, mussels, haddock, and cod. Lai stepped inside to check the cooking. The European green crabs from Cataldo's oyster farm simmered in a tall pot with water, kelp, cardamom, cinnamon sticks, and Sichuan pepper. The smaller Asian shore crabs, after seasoning and arrangement on dehydrator trays, had undergone conversion to a crunchy hand food to be eaten whole, like popcorn shrimp or potato chips. To spread awareness, Lai often invites community organizers, authors, scientists, and artists to his meals. This dinner included two fellow travelers in the invasivore movement, Lula Lou and John Crilly, partners from Kentucky, who have been marketing silver carp, another invasive, and Roman, the professor from Vermont. Roman chatted about scale as we ate bowls of simmered crabs and broth and congee with whole Asian shore crabs atop. There's no way we are going to eradicate something like European green crabs just by harvesting them. I just don't see how any practical way, he said. However, there is this idea of functional eradication. Through harvest, you can reduce the number of green crabs in a particular area, and that can increase the proportion of native shellfish. In this way, Roman said, targeted crab culls could benefit areas of priority, while the crabs would remain entrenched elsewhere. Studies have shown such an effect with densities of lionfish, a spiny, venomous fish from the Indo-Pacific, now abundant in the Atlantic from Brazil to the Carolinas. The fish has been targeted by tournaments and culls, and its frozen meat is sold online. In some areas, as its numbers fell, native species rebounded. I see that as probably being a reasonable way forward, Roman said. Rather than thinking of them as pests, maybe they could be an opportunity. Here's a way that we could combine both our efforts at conservation as well as improving cuisine. Next came a custard with silver carp roe and green crab broth. Atop each bowl of custard sat a whole European green crab, its formerly dark exoskeleton transformed by heat to a pinkish orange hue. Lou spoke up. "That custard was delicious," she said. "That extraction, I'm blown away." Green crab, she said, gave the dish a flavor so savory that she could envision the crabs being used to enrich a new kind of surimi, which is commonly sold as imitation crab made with silver carp meat. The market for surimi is vast, exceeding several billion dollars in sales a year and projected to grow. Liu also saw ethnic markets as a potential customer base eager for small local crustaceans. "I'd like to experiment with them," she said. "It's an incredible market." For his send-off, Bun and me placed before each guest a bowl of ice cream made, Bun said, out of a whole bunch of different weeds. A dried Asian shore crab squatted on top as a garnish. It crunched like a cookie when bitten. Smiles filled the room. We could have eaten a whole bag. Now I'll read a letter of recommendation. It's time to bring back the duel. Quarrels used to be settled with dignity and honor. This is a story by David Wesley Williams. I prefer autumn for a duel, a nip in the air and the thick butterscotch warmth of bourbon, a whiff of wood smoke, the rustle of our feet through the leaves as we walk those 20 paces, the explosion of colors and of pistols, too, of course, deep crimson on that rustled bed of bright orange and amber. Oh, don't mind me. I'm just imagining. I've never been in a duel, of course. We don't allow duels anymore. They're barbaric, archaic. We can just shoot people on the spot now over whatever slight or insult or dust-up has riled us. We don't need rules or a quiet meadow at dawn. The strip mall parking lot outside a suburban Italian restaurant will do. That happened a few years ago where I live. There was a disagreement over two SUVs parked too closely to each other. The men argued, then one went to his vehicle for a gun and shot and killed the other. Over a parking dispute. Over nothing. The judge at the sentencing lamenting how a gun, ever so handy when things became heated, controlled the man's mental condition and emboldened him. A couple of hundred years ago, this quick escalation from mundane to murderous might have taken several days. After the challenge was made and accepted, the duel would have to be scheduled, and a suitably secluded plot of land identified, and the weapons chosen, and the seconds, dueling's version of the bridegroom's best man, signed on. Then the appointed day would come. And what if it rained? Oh, snap. Were there rain outs in dueling, like in baseball? Heck, they might have decided to wait until autumn. Not to make sport of duels, mind. They could be lethal. Alexander Hamilton most famously died for one, shot by his longtime political rival Aaron Burr in a dispute partly over the former's deeming the latter a dangerous man. More than he knew. But dueling, though fraught, was seldom fatal. Only about 7% of duels resulted in death, according to scholars. Consider the early American politicians John Randolph and Henry Clay, who staged what the Kentucky Secretary of State's website calls one of the most ludicrous exchanges in the annals of dueling. After some early misses, Clay put a bullet through Randolph's coat, then braced for his opponent's return fire. Randolph shot harmlessly into the air. No one died or was even wounded that day. "But you owe me a new coat," said Randolph to Clay. "Har." History is strewed with duels that weren't, called off for one reason or another, cooler heads or back-channel collusion or whatever. A young Illinois politician named Abraham Lincoln avoided one rather craftily. When challenged by the aggrieved state auditor James Shields over personal insults, Lincoln chose swords as the weapon in a nod to his height and reach advantage. They met on a Mississippi River sandbar called, a little too aptly, Bloody Island. In a flourish of pre-duel gamesmanship, the future American president swung his sword high and hacked off a tree branch. Shields saw the folly of bringing thin skin to a sword fight, and a truce was called, so the story goes. You could also just apologize and avoid a duel, or your second, cool head to your hot one, could talk you down. This was a crucial part of a second's job, turns out, to see that the duel never came off. So scratch that best man's comparison from earlier. Finally, if the duel could not be avoided, you could always delope. That is, the duelist would miss on purpose a sort of let's not and say we did maneuver with such subterfuge. It's a wonder they didn't do away with pistols altogether. Why not try dirty looks at 20 paces instead? So maybe they were onto something back in the barbaric, archaic United States. Maybe the whole idea of a duel was to give would-be duelists time to cool it, to stand back for a bit and make peace, or anyway, live to loathe another day. Imagine the applications today in this agitated America of ours, where guns, at some 400 million, outnumber the nation's population. We have people taking pot shots at one another on interstates. We have shootings at schools, churches, grocery stores, food courts, hookah lounges, nightclubs, and parks. We have shootings at Easter parties and after prom parties and trail rides. Mix the easy availability of guns with our politics of excitement, incitement, division, and let's call it what it is, old-fashioned hate, the threats, the bullying, the fighting over every little thing, over books and bathrooms and whether facts are facts. Two people of opposing views can't even talk calmly about the weather anymore. There's climate change, you know, unless it's a hoax. See, I've gone and worked myself into a state. Doesn't take much, honestly. Bit of a hothead I am. One more combustible American. I have one of those hair-trigger tempers that's just too quick for me sometimes. It reacts before there's time to stop, think, reason. I don't own a gun, but who's to say I won't get crosswise someday with someone who does? I'll have been a co-conspirator, if a dead one. So it seems to me we need, as a country, a little time to calm our collective bad selves, to temper our flaring tempers. You see what I'm proposing here, don't you? We have to bring it back. Yes, dueling. Think of the lives we'll save. David Wesley Williams is an author whose novel, Come Again No More, will be published this year by Jackleg Press. Now I'll read a couple letters to the ethicist. Should I renounce a religious group that's taken a bad turn? The magazine's ethicist columnist on whether to remain a part of a religious organization that's behaving in an unenlightened manner. And the ethicist is Kwame Anthony Appiah. And the reader writes, I'm in my 50s, and since my college days have been associated with a monastic organization based in India. The founder was Hindu, but he and the organization espoused universal values, and over decades, I've deeply embraced their way of life, forming close bonds with the community. Recently, though, I've noticed monks aligning with the current political regime, privately sharing content hostile to other religions in WhatsApp groups. Attempts to reason with members have failed, and dissent risks ostracism. I'm torn between disconnecting from these groups, which are my main link to the community, and maintaining decades of cherished relationships and personal guidance. Walking away means losing my identity and community, while staying makes me feel guilty inside. Name was withheld. And the ethicist writes, Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, the title of a classic 1970 treatise by the great economist and political scientist Albert O. Hirschman, identified three possible responses to a dysfunctional or failing organization: leaving, speaking up for change, or just sticking it out. It's to your credit that you've used your voice to challenge religious bigotry among these monastics, and in the current atmosphere of Hindutva, your worries about being shunned if you persist are doubtless warranted. It would amount to exit. Exit, alas, means cutting off part of yourself and losing any chance to influence the group. Hirschman knew that people might combine those three strategies in various degrees. And in this spirit, you might consider selective engagement, being part of an online group that includes people promoting a wicked agenda, doesn't make you complicit with that agenda. You can honor the organization's core spiritual practices and original values while quietly distancing yourself from its defections from them, even if you aren't overtly dissenting. Sometimes, as Hirschman knew, staying engaged with flawed institutions allows you to serve as a moderating presence, possibly influencing future developments from within. In fact, Hirschman suggested that when it comes to certain misguided and menacing entities, notably states, what we actually need from wiser policymakers is a measure of spinelessness. That way, some of them would remain inside so that when the moment comes, they might be able to influence things. And yes, he knew that spinelessness was something we usually had in excess. We could dismiss all this as the rationalizations of a closeted academic, yet Kirschman had some firsthand experience in confronting toxic nationalism. Raised in Berlin, he pitched in with the anti-fascists as a student there, fought fascists in the Spanish Civil War, worked with the French resistance, and then, rather than retreating to safety, helped rescue thousands of people from Nazi-occupied Europe. When the stakes were grave, he thought it might be more important to have strong hands than clean hands, and to be around when you could make a difference. And another letter to the ethicist: can accepting money for volunteering be the right thing to do? The magazine's ethicist columnist on the wages of charitable work. And the reader writes, my husband is a physician and volunteers extensively at a rural clinic for uninsured patients. He recently won a local award for his service there. Around the same time, the large nonprofit hospital where we both work informed him that they had overpaid him for the past 2 years and will reduce his future pay to cover the difference. But they are very generously offered to lower the repayment amount based on the number of days he spends volunteering at the clinic, essentially paying him for his work. If we agreed, we would donate back to the clinic the amount the hospital pays him. Financially, we'd be fine and would be helping the clinic. Even so, my husband doesn't want to be paid for something he regards as volunteer work. Because he recently won the award, we also worry that if word got out about his being paid for the work, it might smear his good name. Yet, the clinic would benefit greatly from such a large donation and wouldn't thank us for turning down the hospital's money on principle. What to do? And the ethicist writes, what's at stake for your husband is what kind of person he wants to be, and yes, what kind of person he wishes to be seen as. In the biomedical ethics course you would have taken in medical school, you both were probably introduced to the utilitarian ideal of doing what will produce the most net good. You're wondering whether you can square a concern for character with a concern for consequences. What seems obvious is that accepting the money needn't be conceived as being paid for volunteer work, given that only the clinic would benefit. So should we dismiss his unease as vanity masquerading as ideals? Not necessarily. It may reflect his understanding that the perceived authenticity of charitable work has real implications for the broader culture of service. If people begin to doubt whether celebrated volunteer work is truly uncompensated, it could discourage others from pitching in. The point is that the good we do isn't just a matter of immediate consequences. It can involve sustaining social institutions over the long term. Given your worries, your husband could urge the hospital to donate the relevant amount directly to the clinic instead. This would maintain the purely volunteer nature of your work while benefiting the clinic, reconciling character and consequences. And now from the on-comedy section of the Times, forget the punchline. It's the setup to these jokes that's tricky. Ronnie Cheng, Gary Gulman, and other comics are experimenting with long build-ups that can be audacious when they work. Story by Jason Zinneman. A joke can be broken down into two sections. The setup, which isn't necessarily funny, and the punchline, which better be. Facing a crowd that's looking to laugh, comics tend to want to get to the payoff as quickly as possible. But there's a rich tradition of jokes that move in the opposite direction, where part of what's funny is that the setup keeps going and going long past what you'd expect. The most famous example might be The Aristocrats, the rare joke that inspired its own documentary. An odd bit begins with a setup about family members trying to get an agent to book their act, and its humor tends to be fundamentally dirty and gratuitous. But in the last year, some of the most ambitious new hours have used the long setup to develop more rarefied kinds of jokes, formerly inventive, experimental, and very funny. Witness the magnificently unusual joke midway through Ronnie Cheng's recent special, Love to Hate It, Netflix, which begins with him trying to find common ground with the MAGA movement, saying its supporters have a point that the country has problems. Slowing his aggressive rat-a-tat delivery, he lists evidence of decline, bad health care outcomes, wealth inequality, and just when you expect a punchline to lighten the mood, he even gets more serious. Adopting the tone of a politician, he says that we did not fulfill the implicit promise that if you worked hard and played by the rules, you could make it. At this point, the comedy seems to have ground to a halt. It's also when Cheng's pace shifts from slow and deliberate to pointedly sped up as he rapidly unspools a grand unified theory. The tempo of his hard-to-follow chatter, which covers tax and trade policy, among other economic minutiae, indicate a departure from logical argument and a venture into the ridiculous. He recalls how everyone from Stanley Kubrick to Benny Hill had used fast-forward to create comedy. What's impressive is not the insight of the analysis, though it's incoherent if you follow with subtitles, but how Cheng controls the crowd response with the pace instead of the subject. Even if they can't keep up with what he's saying, everyone laughs at the same moment because of when he shifts gears. The comic moves here are all in the form. It all builds to a satirical point about the difference in messaging between left and right when Cheng stops speechifying, takes a breath, and utters the punchline. But if you don't read enough, it comes out. Let's go, Brandon. Most stand-ups wouldn't try this joke because going for such a long stretch without anything resembling a punchline could be greeted by silence, the worst fate for a comic. Gary Gulman's new show, Grandiloquent, at the Lucille Lortel Theater is about, among other things, this anxiety, how an insecure need for approval emerged from childhood, what distorting effects it had on his personality, and how, as he puts it, it contributes to the subtext of his entire career. I'm smart, right? It's why Gulman, a masterly joke technician, has always favored words like grandiloquent, which means the use of extravagant language in an attempt to impress. This show-offy instinct has long benefited him. In a culture more terrified of elitism than philistinism, Gulman creates brainy, word-drunk art that aims high. This show covers familiar ground for Gulman, but also ventures deeper into the therapist's office. He's mocking and celebrating his try-hard personality while also delivering his most emotional comedy. It's a lot, and it becomes unbalanced in an epic-long joke that is, in its audaciousness, impressive. It begins as he and his wife are listening to a song in the car by the band Audioslave, and she asks an innocent question. Who sings this? This poor woman has no idea what's about to hit her. a monologue covering, among other things, the history of grunge, the basketball player Mookie Blaylock, the author Mary Shelley, and the old English poem Beowulf. This apotheosis of mansplaining goes on for many minutes, a tenth of the script. The one-sided scene ends with his wife saying dryly, "Oh, we're here." With a coat, tie, and Van Dyke beard, Goldman looks like the head of a very important, money-strapped literary publishing house. His onstage magnetism is considerable, and the fact that he holds your attention, even getting laughs at his own expense through this pointedly tedious lecture, is a testament to his gifts. It's a laudable effort, but it distorts the show, proving an awkward lead-in to a more heartfelt coda. The thing about these long jokes is that they are high-risk, high-reward. Hannah Einbinder's special last year, Everything Must Go, Max, had many eccentric jokes, but the most memorable was an extreme vibe shift when she described a miraculous epiphany at her grandmother's funeral. She started singing a Hebrew prayer that interrupted the jokes and went on for nearly 2 minutes. After she finished, she asked how she sang this prayer despite not knowing Hebrew. In that moment, a comedy had become something like a religious mystery. Then it hit her. It's the song at the end of Schindler's List. In each of these long jokes from Chang and Goldman and Einbinder, there comes a moment when the comedy stems from disbelief that the setup is going on this long. Norm MacDonald, whose moth joke is one of the great examples of the long form, actually did something similar on Saturday Night Live. In a bit he wrote for Weekend Update, cut after dress rehearsal, Chris Farley tells a story about meeting a guy and starting to say something to him. Then Farley sputters and repeats himself until he admits he forgot what he was going to say. It's all set up. Then a fizzle of a punchline. And yet it remains hilarious and oddly relatable. Who has not excitedly begun a story then forgotten what they were going to say? A punchline is by its nature artificial, contrived, a pat resolution. Replacing that with a simple bit of recognizable human behavior can sometimes be the funniest twist. Jason Zinnemann is a critic at large for the culture section of the Times and writes a column about comedy. More about Jason Zinnemann. And I'll finish with Judge John Hodgman on joking with strangers. All the world's a stage, within reason. And Ryan writes, I was in a crowded grocery store when I heard a person call out, Marco, to their child. I instinctively responded, Polo. The person seemed annoyed and sarcastically replied, like we've never heard that one before, then walked away, presumably to find their child. I was only trying to bring joy into the world. And the judge writes, I'm sitting in a busy coffee shop as I write this. While I was contemplating your case, a woman asked if she could take the seat across from me. Sensing an opportunity, I said, absolutely not. Ha ha, boy, did that bring down the house. It didn't. Because even though I immediately smiled and said, of course you may, it was still confusing and destabilizing to a person who was, after all, just trying to go on about her morning. Now imagine how she would feel if her son was missing in a grocery store. Anyway, as soon as another seat opened up, she got away from me as quickly as possible, as will others in your life, until you learn the world is not your improv stage. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.